You're listening to Sustainable from AgriBusiness Global, covering the crop protection, biologicals, and plant health markets' advancements towards creating a healthier planet.
Hi, my name is Renee Targus. I'm the editor for AgriBusiness Global. Today, I'm speaking with Kristin Sukulak. She's a consulting partner at Prospero & Partners and a permanent representative of the European Biostimulants Industry Council. Welcome, Kristin.
Thank you, Renee.
So why don't you tell me and our listeners a little bit about you and your company?
Okay, thanks. So Prospero & Partners has been around for almost 25 years. We were founded in 1999 by my partner, Sarah Verplanken. And the company started as a strategic communications company. And over time has evolved into much more of what would probably be classified as a strategy and management consultancy. But what we have developed that's really unique is a specialization on agribusiness and bio-based industries that are often somehow related to agriculture. And this is kind of come about naturally over time. And what it means is that we have a really unique perspective because we understand the technologies of our clients and their markets and how those products are used in agriculture and all of the consumer concerns about agriculture and everything. But we provide complementary skill sets where our clients tend to have a lot of technical expertise. We bring expertise that's really focused more in the social sciences and the human systems. So it's things around, you know, how do you get innovation out there? How do you get it taken up? How do you make room for it in the wider world, taking into account political science and psychology and sociology and economics and a lot of these human factors that people, especially if they're founders who are coming with a technical breakthrough, but don't necessarily have business experience and certainly don't necessarily have stakeholder relations experience. And so we provide expertise that a lot of small companies simply can't have internally. And even a lot of larger companies don't necessarily have the emphasis that we do on understanding that just because you have a great technology, it doesn't mean that it's going to be adopted by end users if they're farmers, but also, you know, by consumers and policymakers who need to understand the technologies and how to get it to fit into the existing institutional framework.
Going along those lines, you know, what are the two mistakes that you're seeing that many of the small to mid-sized companies are doing before launching a new crop protection product, specifically within biostimulants or the biological area?
Yeah, I think in agriculture in general, for a long time through the whole Green Revolution period, that corresponded to a historical period when there was this absolute love affair with technology and a belief that technology could solve everything. And I don't want to in any way say that technology is a bad thing. Technology and innovation are absolutely great things. But having a purely technocratic approach to problem solving tends to fail quite often. And this is especially true in a field like agriculture and food production, where food in particular is a very unique product compared to anything else because we literally are what we eat. You know, we ingest food, we take it into our bodies. If we have a healthy diet, then we're going to be healthier. If, you know, we're ingesting things that are bad for us, even if it's just the quality of the food that's bad for us. But then, of course, if we ingest toxic things, et cetera. And I think what many, many companies, especially I think small startups that often there's a founder who will have made a breakthrough in a lab or something like that, and who just, you know, thinks their technology and their innovation is going to change the world and the world is just going to, you know, open up before them and do everything to adopt their technology. I think the biggest mistake is not understanding that technology alone is not enough, in that throughout history there have been many, many great technological innovations or inventions, I'd say, because you have to be adopted in order to become an innovation. And, you know, that bridge from invention to innovation and getting people to understand your technology, to take it up, that's actually all about human beings and about the quirks of human beings. And coming at it with a purely technical, rational mindset, you're almost guaranteed to fail and certainly to underperform what your potential could be. So I think the number one mistake that we see is companies not understanding that they need a balance, and they need people like ourselves who understand the human dynamics of innovation and adoption of innovation and wider societal acceptance of innovation in order to make sure that their technology is going to have all of the chances it deserves.
Is there another mistake that you see these companies doing as far as like not preparing for the financial challenges that are going to happen if they're trying to register a new product? Or do you see any sort of strategy issues going on?
Yeah, I think some of the strategy issues, I mean, certainly understanding how much money it takes to get products to market. And again, it depends on which products you're talking about, because anything that falls under the crop protection framework, we have a framework that was developed for synthetic chemical pesticides. And the thing about that that I think a lot of people don't think about is the synthetic chemical pesticides, when they were invented, these were novel molecules. We literally knew nothing about them when they were invented. So it was completely understandable that there was this really rigorous testing and examination process in order to try to have reassurances of, you know, acceptable levels of risk and things like that. When we're looking at biocontroller, biostimulants, or other bio-based products, it's actually very different because there's a lot of empirical knowledge that's available based on the fact that the biochemicals and the microorganisms that we're working with are being sourced from nature and are actually being employed by nature in the systems that are functioning. So we have regulatory frameworks at the moment that were built for a specific purpose and are now being used for a different purpose. And I think that there's an assumption that, well, oh, because I have a natural substance, you know, people are just going to accept it and it's going to be fine. And there is a lack of realization of how heavy the process is, how long the process is, the investment that needs to be made in the testing and the evaluation and things like that. I think also from a strategy perspective, another mistake that we're seeing made a lot in the biological space is not understanding the long road between an observation in an experimental or laboratory context and translating that into a stable, reliable product that produces predictable results once deployed in an extremely volatile world, because the agriculture, compared to many, many other products that we use, you put the products out there in the field, you can't predict what's going to happen as far as the weather. You can't predict what's going to happen as far as animals coming into the field. There's just so many things that can influence what happens in the field. And people who try to take a shortcut from, oh, I've observed something under, you know, controlled conditions where I could isolate variables, and they just jump to selling that and making, let's call them, very optimistic promises about what the product can provide without going through an iterative process of actually putting the product into real world conditions, thinking about elaborating formulations that are going to ensure stability, that are going to assure the best conditions for application. And there's just such a long, sophisticated journey between observation under controlled conditions and actually having a really great product out in the field. And just one example I saw of that recently, which, you know, I've been working in this field now for over 20 years, and this one had never occurred to me, but I was visiting an R&D center for a big company. And the one stop on this that really struck me was the one where they were talking about the different technical additives that can be used in products and how they can change the quality of the product. And the example they showed us was an additive that they had put into a product that is delivered in a powdered form, and the farmer puts it into solution and then applies it. And they showed their product, which had this one technical additive, and then a competing product that didn't have the technical additive. And you saw the example was in one case, it stayed in solution so well that it basically looked like it had completely dissolved and you had a, you know, a uniform color throughout the entire product, and it stayed that way. And the other product that didn't have this additive, and you saw that most of the powder was in the bottom half of the beaker and it was a much lighter color at the top. And that's the kind of thing, if you just start from an observation under controlled conditions and you haven't gone through these sorts of processes in order to improve the technical quality of the product, you're not at the end of the day going to get the same performance, even if you've got the exact same, you know, active ingredient. So for me, that was just a reminder of how important that, you know, it's not just about research, it's research and development. And companies need to spend a lot more time on development, especially the smaller companies that jump from research to the field.
You know, speaking along those lines, are there any companies that you see are doing really well with research and development and strategy and marketing? Do you see any examples of somebody sort of standing out in the biological space that you could recommend, like, this is how you should be doing it?
Well, you know, I don't want to make enemies or friends, but I think there are some companies that have, I think any of the companies that you see that have committed to really having a sort of gold standard for their R&D, where they really provide extensive information to farmers about all of the different trials that they have done under different conditions, where they show the work that they have done in iterative processes in order to do product improvement. And I, what I've seen in recent years, which has really struck me, is more and more biostimulant companies, which tend to be quite small, are building their own in-house labs if they didn't already have them. Many of them started off completely doing all of their research in cooperation with universities. And I think the fact that more of them are putting in place in-house labs shows a growing sophistication and is showing a growing understanding of that need to do that development process. And whereas you can do the research in cooperation with the universities, the product development process is really more of an internal process that needs to be done by the company, because they need to look at what they can tweak in the process, what they can tweak as far as additives and things like that. And that's something where, you know, the agronomic researchers, that's not their strong point. So I think what's a really positive sign is seeing the number of companies that their labs have expanded from just quality control to really these, you know, these innovation and development labs, still working a lot of times in cooperation with universities to get that sort of upstream research done. And then the companies that are really going out and testing things in the field with farmers in an iterative fashion, you know, the basic thing that I would say is the more data that a company can show about all of the research they've done in order to try and get more reliable results, but also to, quite often, I think the more sophisticated companies narrow the claims that they make for their products rather than broadening them, because they get a better understanding of what are the factors that allow this product to perform best for farmers and what are the factors that are going to prevent it from performing to the farmers. And they're honest about what are the realistic conditions for the use of the product. And I think that's where you'll really see the companies that stand out, is the ones that are not promising the sun and the moon and the stars, but the ones that are actually saying, you know what, we want to stand by what we know we can deliver, and we're not going to promise more than what we're really confident of and we have the data to show.
And with the biostimulant market really booming in Brazil, the United States, Europe, with these companies, there's a lot of companies starting to create these products. And a lot of Indian companies are starting to diversify their portfolio and they're starting to add biostimulants. What can these companies do to get a place in these growing markets?
My experience is primarily working in the European context, although working with companies quite often that are multinational. And I think what's really important, especially for bio-based products like biostimulants and biocontrol, is you need a real dialogue with the farmers in order to educate them. The difference between the bio-based products from the previous generations of agricultural inputs like fertilizers and traditional crop protection products is that before, the knowledge was basically all in the product and with very simple instructions. You know, you could say to a farmer, okay, if you've got a nitrogen deficiency, you apply this product in this way at this rate, and that's going to fill the deficiency so that the plant will fix it. And it was also very similar with pesticides in that, okay, you know, you've got an infestation, you spray this according to these directions, and that's going to fix it. With the bio-based products, instead of that kind of binary process, what it really is the farmers need to have a much more holistic mindset about what is the effect that these products are going to have on very complex systems where there are other factors adding in as well. So helping them understand how to integrate bio-based products into their growing regimes isn't just that easily summarized on label instructions. It's really helping them understand, okay, if you have a biostimulant that helps with nutrient use efficiency, maybe that means you need to reduce how much fertilizer you're applying in order to get the best results, because the biostimulant isn't necessarily going to increase yields to a huge extent. But what they could potentially do is allow you to get the same or slightly better yields, but with a bit less fertilizer. So you're using your fertilizer more efficiently. And that's something that it's hard to, I think, communicate just on label instructions. And I think if you look at biocontrol, it's a similar sort of, it's, you know, I don't want to say knowledge transfer, because I think that underrates the intelligence and the innovative of farmers themselves. But I think it's really co-creation of knowledge, especially because I think every farmer's growing conditions are slightly different. And so it's bringing to the farmer what you can tell them about the product and the factors that will help it be most effective for the farmer, but then helping the farmer to figure out in their unique circumstances, what are the changes that they need to make. And of course, advisors are very important in that, where there are good advisor systems. So I think getting into new markets for any company really requires not just having good relationships with distributors, but also building relationships with advisors or farmer cooperatives or whatever the organizations are that really allow for that dialogue about how to tweak growing systems in order to incorporate these products, which require a more holistic approach than previous generations of agri inputs.
Right. You know, another area I'm seeing too, these growing markets, is a lot of like Syngenta acquiring Valagro, and then you've got Corteva with Stoller, and you've got all these large multinationals acquiring these other companies, these like mid-sized companies. Do you see a trend in how these companies are making themselves more attractive to these larger companies to be acquired, or what that sort of relationship is, how they're being selected? I don't know if that's kind of going beyond your scope, but you know, from what you're seeing in the European market, are you seeing there's a sort of trend as far as who's getting acquired and who's not?
I think it depends on the exact situation, because I don't think it's just about a company that's being acquired, but I also think it's about the mindset of the company that's doing the acquiring. I think in the early days, if we kind of look over the past decade at some of the early acquisitions, I think there was this mistaken belief by some of these bigger companies that they could just acquire a bio-based technology and kind of plug it into the system in a plug and play way, and it was gonna go. The problem is all of those companies were built for more traditional crop protection products, where you basically could just put relatively simplistic instructions on the label and off it went. And so there's been this internal culture gap between the way that you use bio-based products, the types of results you're gonna see from bio-based products, and therefore how you market them, because you can't just market on the basis of you're going to get a 15% increase in yield, you're going to protect 85% of your crop from pests or whatever. It's really a much more sophisticated marketing that's reliant very much on building these relationships of trust with advisors and with farmers themselves. So I think what happens is you see acquisitions where the two sides, kind of there's a meeting of the minds. So on the one side, you'll either have a company that still is thinking they can just plug and play and buy individual technologies. Usually my experiences from seeing those is there tends to be kind of a fizzle where you don't hear much about the acquired technology after that because it doesn't sort of take in the way that the acquirer had hoped. But I think, and you cited, for example, Syngenta and Velagro, and I think that's a case where you have an acquiring company that has worked and continues to work to adjust its own internal mindset to understand what's different from the older generations of inputs and the newer generations. And then you have a company that, although much smaller, but still, it's one of the bigger sort of native biostimulant companies, if you will, a company that has really worked to try to develop the kind of discipline around the R&D process, with an emphasis on the development side in order to really have very solid science-based results. And I think, when you have an acquirer who can start to make the cultural changes necessary to understand the bio-based products and the changes that the wider agricultural system has to go through as bio-based products become more generalized. And then when you have a company that, without losing that part of their spark and their innovation, still, has invested in the R&D and especially the development side of things, I think that's where we're seeing some of the more promising partnerships and acquisitions coming up in recent years.
Is there anything else you wanted to add that you think is important on this topic as far as biostimulants being brought to market or the biocontrols brought to market?
Well, I think we're, especially for biostimulants, I think we're at a really exciting time because there are so many contextual factors that are coming together to really facilitate a change in practices. Because on the one hand, if we look at the global fertilizer markets and, the combination of prices and difficulties of access in some places into some products. The other thing we're seeing is, there's the whole class of biostimulants that help with coping with abiotic stresses like extreme temperatures and drought and flooding conditions and stuff like that. And because of climate viability, we really, really see the need for those kinds of products emerging in the last couple of years. Because if we just take the last 2 or 3 years in Europe alone, we've had in the same season, late frost, hot and dry summers, and then when the rain comes, it comes in floods. So farmers are really suddenly experiencing the results of climate change and having to cope with them and try to save some of their crop under these really difficult conditions. So I think there's, two major drivers of the uptake of biostimulants in coming years. I think the dynamic for biocontrol is not completely divorced from that, but it's slightly different because there is going to be a need for different approaches to pests and things with climate change bringing new pests in and all of that. But from what I see, the major drivers for biocontrol seem to be more pushed from the regulatory side with the fact that traditional chemical pesticides are under more and more pressure. And therefore, there is this growing demand from consumers and municipalities who have parks and things and all of that to want to have a softer approach to biocontrol. What will be interesting to see with regard to, the whole biocontrol thing is as the climate variability combined with factors like the fertilizer supply because of the war in Ukraine and everything, as those are suddenly reawakening concerns about global food security and having crises in the supply of agricultural products, it will be interesting to see if that slows down the transition on biocontrol at all, because people are so risk averse with regard to the possibility of losing an additional percentage of crops when we're already in very tight markets and very stressed conditions for the supply of certain products. I think from a geopolitical perspective, though, what we could potentially see happening is a little bit of a reorganization of where different crops are sourced. So I think they'll probably continue to be grown and sourced from the places that they have been in the past, but we might see more of a diversification where you've got, major food companies around the world that instead of buying all of their vegetable oils from Ukraine and Russia might start investing in farmers in South America and Africa. And, you know, it potentially could be a positive influence for development in Africa, the turbulence we've been seeing in the agriculture and food over the past couple of years, because there is this need not to turn away from these suppliers we've had in the past, but simply just like after COVID, you know, with medical supplies, there was this realization we need to diversify suppliers, even if that means that, you know, our total costs are a little bit higher, but we've gained resilience as a result of that. I think we're seeing something similar starting, I think, in agriculture. It's just that it's a slower process because getting agricultural value chains and trade corridors and everything set up doesn't happen overnight.
That's really good insight. Well, thank you, Kristen. Again, just to remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Kristen Sukulak. She's a consulting partner at Prospero & Partners. You can learn more about her company at prospero.ag. She's also a permanent representative of the European Biostimulants Industry Council. And again, they can look you up online as far as what that organization is doing, because there's a lot of really interesting work going on. Thank you again, Kristen.
Thank you for listening to Sustainable from Agribusiness Global. You can find more podcasts, videos, news, e-newsletters, event, and webinar information at agribusinessglobal.com.